Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Washington County Historical Association on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Kenneth Morris, great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, and great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, as well as co-founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative in Atlanta, Georgia. He'll speak on the topic History, Human Rights, and the Power of One. His remarks were given as the keynote of a fundraising effort to enable Arlington Public Schools history teacher Barry Jurgensen to retrace the 500-mile route from Nebraska City to Chicago of two escaped slaves who traveled the path to freedom through the Underground Railroad in 1858. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, March 11, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Washington County Historical Association, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to speak on history, human rights, and the power of one is Kenneth Morris.
Thank you all for being here tonight. Anytime I have an opportunity to talk about this heritage, this blood that flows through my veins, and to talk about my family, I always feel so honored and blessed. Now, I am the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. And I'm also the great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Wow. And every time I tell people what my relationship is to these American heroes, not only is it a mouthful trying to spit out all of those greats, but it sometimes makes me feel very far removed. And you may be sitting there having a hard time trying to imagine what my connection is to Douglass and Washington. It's like trying to picture what $1 billion looks like with all of those zeros. But just by a show of hands, how many of you know or knew a grandparent? Just about everybody. How about a great-grandparent? Well, that's how close I feel to both Douglass and Washington, because my great-grandmother, Fanny Douglass, to whom I was very close, she lived to be 103 years old. She lived well into my 20s. She met Frederick Douglass when she was a little girl. And my Aunt Portia, to whom I was also very close, she lived to be 95 years old. And she was Booker T. Washington's daughter. And I remember being a little boy and sitting on my great-grandmother Fanny Douglass's lap as she would tell me what it was like to know, as she called him, the man with the great big white hair. And I remember sitting on my Aunt Portia's lap, and she would tell me firsthand stories about her father, Booker T. Washington. And one day it hit me. I was thinking about this. Hands that actually touched the great Frederick Douglass and hands that touched the great Booker T. Washington also touched mine. In a sense, even with all of those greats, I can say I stand just one person away from history, one person away from slavery. And I've had the honor and privilege since we started doing this work in 2007 to dialogue and present in front of more than, I think, 70,000 students we're up to now, face-to-face. And when I talk to students, we're in middle schools and high schools mostly, and I say, I'm the great-great-great-grandson, the great-great-great-grandson, and they look at me just cross-eyed like, wow, you are so far removed. What does this have to do with us in today? So I love sharing that story with them, because we just, in this past December, commemorated the 150th anniversary of the 13th Amendment, the ratification of the 13th Amendment, which legally outlawed or abolished slavery in this country. And so when you think about 150 years, it sounds like a long time, but when you consider the generations of families, it's not that long. And I travel around and I speak to a lot of groups, and I'll have people come sometimes say to me afterwards, well, this is 150 years ago. It's time to get over it. You know, let's move on. But when you think about trauma in families, whether that be sexual abuse, alcoholism, whatever it may be, there's a cycle of trauma that continues, and it's hard to break that cycle. So as we've come out of slavery, as my ancestors came out of slavery, there was no plan for emancipation. There was no counseling. There was no post-traumatic stress disorder designation. They had been separated from their families. They didn't know how to read and write for the most part. They didn't have homes or jobs or land or anything. And there was the trauma and the embarrassment. So these stories were not passed on. What we do with our work is we go by Frederick Douglass's quote. He has a famous quote that said, "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." And we believe if we're going to get and fight against any of these social ills in our communities, if we can work with children and get them to understand what's happening in the world around them, how media shapes who they are, how oppressive things can be in nature to hold them back, and how in a lot of cases our young people are living in mental bondage. They may not be in physical bondage, but they're in mental bondage. So what I hope to do tonight is I hope to inspire you with the stories of my ancestors. Because they were two men that were born slaves. They were born into the most horrific conditions that a human being could be subjected to. But yet through the power of education, now Frederick Douglass never spent one day of his life in a classroom. Because as we know, it was illegal to teach a slave to read and write. So he was a self-taught scholar. In fact, people used to ask him later in life, "Frederick, where did you go to school? Where did you get your education?" And he would respond by saying, "My degree is written on my back." And Booker T. Washington benefited from the work of Douglass and the abolitionists, and he was freed when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, and he was 9 years old, so he was able to start to go to school. But both of my ancestors understood at a very tender age, young age, that education was their key to freedom. And they understood that knowledge was power. And this is a message that's relevant today for our young people, as I said, that are living in mental bondage. And when I talk to kids, they say all the time, "Well, my parents or my grandparents say, I got to go to school, I got to go to college." And what does that mean? It goes in one ear and out the other. But when they can look at the legacies of great heroes and heroines that came before, that sacrificed so much, then they become tangible examples that if they were able to overcome slavery, and it doesn't get any worse than that, in my opinion, if they were able to overcome slavery through education and knowledge, that there's nothing that our young people can't do in their own lives today when they look at those examples. So I hope to inspire you with their legacies tonight in the same way that we inspire students with their legacies. And I thought what I would do is, I'm sure a lot of you are fans of history. And history is important for a lot of reasons. I'm passionate about history because I think we need to know where we've come from in order to know where we're headed. And so what I thought I would do tonight is bring some photographs of my family that are not in the history books. And for our young people, when they look at these great people from history, it's sometimes hard for them to imagine that they were living people that actually did something that really affected change. So I want to make history come alive tonight for you. Now, the question that I get the first time people meet me, usually, is, well, I get two questions. The first one is, "So you're related to Frederick Douglass and the Booker T. Washington? Well, what do you do?" And they always follow that up with, "And it better be good." So I'm going to tell you about what I do as president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, and as we heard, why we need modern abolitionists today, because slavery still exists. Now, the other question that I get is, "Well, Booker Washington and Frederick Douglass were not related to each other, so how is it you're related to both of them?" Well, here's how it happened. It happened on my mom's side of the family. Top left corner, you can see Frederick Douglass was born in 1818. He passed away in 1895. He had 5 children. I descend from his youngest son, Charles Remond Douglass, who had a son by the name of Joseph Henry Douglass. Joseph had a son by the name of Frederick Douglass III, who's my grandfather. On the other side, you have Booker T. Washington, who was born in 1856, passed away in 1915. He had three children. I told you about my Aunt Portia, but I descend through his oldest son, Booker T. Washington II, who had a daughter, Nettie Hancock Washington, and that's my grandmother. So check this out. My grandparents were at Tuskegee Normal School and Institute, which is a school that Booker T. Washington founded in 1881. They happened to be on campus the same day. My grandmother, who was born in Tuskegee, was actually living in California at the time, and my grandfather, who was a surgeon, had been commissioned down to Tuskegee by the Veterans Administration during World War II. So just by chance, they happened to be on campus the same day because my grandmother was home for summer vacation. So they're rushing across to get to the other side, and they literally bump into each other. Didn't know that the other descended from an historic family. They fell in love at first sight and wound up getting married 3 months later. So I think it was meant to be. There was a plan there. And when my mom was born, Nettie Washington Douglas, she was the first person to unite the bloodlines of the families. She was an only child, so I have the honor and the blessing to be the first male to unite the bloodlines. I love this photograph. This is my grandparents on their wedding day. And doesn't my grandmother look like a movie star in that? To her right, on the left of the screen, is my grandfather, Frederick Douglass III. And to her left, on the right, is her brother, Booker T. Washington III. So the significance of this photograph is you have Frederick Douglass III shaking hands with Booker T. Washington III. And thus, the two families are officially united. So here's the man with the great big white hair before he got the great big white hair. And my great-great-great-grandmother, Anna Murray Douglas, who I am as equally proud of her contributions. And her contributions have really been lost to history. They were married for 44 years. Anna was born a free black woman in Baltimore, but she never learned to read and write. So historians and people will question, how could this man of such great intellect be with a woman who didn't have any interest in learning to read and write? Well, if they were married for 44 years, you know that there was a lot there. But most importantly, she met Frederick when he was still enslaved, and he was in Baltimore. And she planted the seed of thought in his mind that you are not meant to be a slave. And she said, when we get married one day, I don't want our children's father to be a slave. So when you think about history and how every moment in time we're making history today right now for what's going to happen after we leave here. So if you think about Anna not placing that thought in his mind, who knows, would he have had the courage to eventually run away? She also sold a feather bed and helped to sew the costume that he would use to disguise himself. So she financed his escape and helped him. They would eventually meet up, and I'll talk in detail about how he escaped in just a little bit. But she is an important person in history because history could be very different had this very strong woman not put that thought in his mind. The other thing that she would do is she would press his clothes, clean his clothes, and send them ahead to the destination where he was going. So when he was out around the world, around the country speaking, she always wanted him to have fresh, clean, sharp clothes. And we know he always looked good. And that was Anna that did that. And then she would send money. He would send money home, and he would be surprised that when he would come home that there was more money than he sent home because she was great with mathematics and accounting and investing. So she was a very important person, and our family is so proud of her, just like we are of Frederick. So on the Booker T. Washington side, I love this photograph of him. He looks so distinguished and sharp, and he's got that book. That's a great educator. So this is my great-great-grandmother, Olivia, and this photograph is with the boys. Now, I mentioned Portia. She's not in this picture, obviously, but I descend from Booker Jr., who's in the center, and then to his left is his brother Ernest, and then, of course, the great Dr. Booker T. Washington. So Frederick Douglass was born Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. He was born on the eastern shore of Maryland to a black woman who was enslaved and to a white man, and it was presumed that his father was his master. Never had a pair of pants or shoes until he was 8 years old. He used to sleep headfirst in an old corn sack on cold winter nights with his feet hanging out because that was the only way he could try and keep himself warm. He only saw his mother three times his whole life. And that's because she lived on a plantation that was 12 miles away. So the federal government and the slave master, in addition to making it illegal to educate slaves, they also broke families up and separated babies from their mothers. He was separated at about a year old. So she would work on this plantation picking cotton from sunup to sundown, and she would walk 12 miles in the middle of the night just to spend a few precious moments with her son until he would fall asleep, and then she would walk 12 miles back so she could be back on the plantation by the time the sun came up, because if she wasn't, she was most likely going to face punishment or whipping. So he was raised by his grandmother. And his grandmother's job on the plantation, I should say he was raised until the age of six, and his grandmother's job on the plantation was to raise the master's children and grandchildren and to raise the slave children until they were old enough to begin their life in manual labor. And Frederick later said in life, he said, "I didn't know I was a slave until I found out I couldn't do the things that I wanted to do." And at the age of six, his grandmother was going to show him what slavery was about. He was going to enter the hell of slavery. And she said, "We're going to go on a 20-mile walk, and we're going to walk to the main plantation." Now, Frederick doesn't know what's happening, but he knows he's walking a long distance, and he's clinging to his grandmother's skirt. She's carrying him much of the way when he can't, his legs can't carry himself. And they would finally make this last mile walk. And she would put him down, set him down, and they would look at each other. And for most of my life, I thought about what must that conversation have been like? I mean, I imagine that there was probably a lot of crying, clinging to each other, and just he was scared and didn't want to break away. And that's how I'd always thought about that conversation. And one time I was talking with a group of sixth graders and told about this story, and this girl raises her hand, student, and she says, "Mr. Morris, my grandmother is really a strong person, and I bet you that she said something to him in that moment that was going to make him believe he could be great, and that would carry him through the rest of his life so that he would do great things to change the world." Now, of course, we don't know, and the historian here would say, yeah, you can think that all you want, but until we have documents and a tape recording to prove it. But I truly believe that happened. She had to have said something, because how do you explain that this boy, who had no family, he had no home, and he had no country, was able to go on to do the things that he did? So now he runs away to see where he is on the plantation. He turns around to look for his grandmother, and she's gone. And the only person that showed him any kind of love and nurturing in his life is now completely gone, and he is alone. He doesn't know his brothers and sisters, his mother, his father. He is truly alone. But he did have something happen in his life that he called divine providence in his favor. And here's one of those other moments in history where this moment in time changed the course of history in this country and the world. And that was, he was chosen from among all of the slave children on the plantation on the Eastern Shore. And this was a big plantation. There were hundreds of enslaved Africans. He was chosen to go and be the house servant for his master's brother, Hugh Auld, in Baltimore, in a big city. Now, the importance of this move was, had he stayed on the plantation, he wouldn't have been in an environment where he could learn how to read and write, because the slaves on the plantation were illiterate. Now he was going to be in the big city. He was going to be around free black children that could read and write, and he was going to be around white children. But what happened most importantly was, when he got there, his slave mistress had never had slaves before. I love this part. And she didn't know that it was illegal to teach him to read and write. So she began to teach young Frederick his ABCs. But when her husband found out about it, when Frederick's master found out, he forbade it. And he said, "You cannot teach a slave how to read and write, because if you do, it will unfit him to be a slave." This is at the foundation of the work that we do, which I'll talk about in a few moments. We want to unfit communities to allow slavery to thrive and exist through education, through institutionalized prevention education. So Frederick looks at his master and he said, if he doesn't want me to have this, I'm going to do everything in my power to gain it. And he understood right then and there that knowledge was power and it would be his key to freedom. So he would do everything in his power to teach himself to read and write. And one of the ways that he would do that would be he would trade bread for reading lessons with the kids in the neighborhood. And he was clever. He would pick something off the ground to scratch on a wall or to write with. And he would say, come and help me, come and help me. Is this how you write a T? And they would say, no, Freddie D, this is how you write a T. You see, pigs are eating out of a pig straw. In his first autobiography, The Narrative of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, which was published in 1845, in there he wrote about how hungry he was as a slave child, that he always had this pit of hunger in his stomach that would never go away. And on occasion, when he would get food, the overseer would take cornmeal mush, throw it into a pig's trough, and all of the children would crawl on their hands and knees as fast as they could to eat out of there, to try to eat with little food and to eat like pigs, to eat like animals. And that's what he was considered. He was property. He didn't own himself. He was no better than the horses and the sheep and the cattle and the pigs. And if you looked at the master's ledger of assets, you would see all of these animals and you would see, you know, horses and carriages and homes and farmland. And then one slave boy, Frederick, with a value next to his name. He was property. He didn't own himself. And remember I just said that he traded bread for reading lessons? He traded food, something of such great importance and value. This is another great lesson for our young people, to ask them. Now, of course, they know how to read and write, so it's not apples to apples, but they get the message that, would you trade? And I'll ask them, what do you value today? And they say, well, PlayStations and Wii's and Madden football. And I always get the iPhone number wrong. I say, what, the iPhone 16, right? And they correct me and they say it's the 5 or the 6 or something. Would you trade that for reading lessons? And very few hands will come up, and those are the ones that are being honest. And I'll say, I don't know that I would have either, but they get that message of the importance and how important it was to Frederick. What his master predicted happened, he became unruly. He became unfit to be a slave. He's getting older now. He's getting stronger. He's getting smarter because he's teaching himself, and he's realizing that while he is not physically free from the chains that are binding him, he's on his way to being mentally free. So you couldn't tell him what to do. All the whippings in the world could not get him to submit. They were trying to break him down, to dehumanize him. So he was sent away to a slave breaker by the name of Edward Covey. Covey had a reputation for breaking slaves. That's what he did. And Douglass was hired out to him for a full year. And when he got there, Covey began to whip him. He'd whip him so bad that the welts on his back wouldn't have a chance to heal, and he would whip him again. Again, Frederick later in life said, when he was writing his autobiography, the pen with which I'm writing these words down on paper, I could take and I could set and rest within the fissures and the cracks of my feet that have never closed shut. This is how brutal slavery was, and to Frederick. So after 6 months of taking these beatings, he had had enough. And he decided that he was going to strike his own blow for his own liberation. And he and Covey had an epic 2-hour battle, which was really a wrestling match, because Frederick understood he couldn't beat him, he couldn't kill him, because he would most likely face the same fate. So he was smart enough to strategically fight him and wrestle. So if you can imagine, they're wrestling and it's going on. You've got this big 16-year-old boy and this slave breaker, and people start to gather around and they're watching. And then Covey's holding Frederick by the neck, and he looks over to the guy over here and says, can you help me? Can you help me? And nobody wanted any part of Frederick. And finally, after 2 hours, Covey gave up. He quit. Frederick was with him another 6 months. And Covey never laid another finger on him. So now he said, he stood there and he said, "You have seen how a boy has been made a slave. Now you've also seen how a slave has been made a man." So he would go on to make his first attempt to escape at the age of 18. They found out about his plan, arrested him. He was thrown in jail for a couple of weeks. And then at the age of 20 in 1838, he disguised himself as a sailor. And here's now where Anna comes into the picture. And he would finally escape the chains. He would go on to New York City. He and Anna would meet up and get married. He would change his name to Frederick Douglass. They would eventually settle in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Now, I don't have time because of, you know, we've got a lot to talk about here, so I'm not going to dive really deep into his importance and what he did. But what I want you to know is that when he did escape slavery, he ended up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and he was at an anti-slavery meeting that was being held by the white abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison. And Garrison heard that he had this fugitive slave in the audience. And so he asked Frederick, "Will you come up? Will you just tell us your story? Share with the audience what it was like to be a slave." So Frederick walks up and he said he was so nervous, his knees were knocking together. He was shaking from every limb. But when he started to tell his story, he had a natural gift for communication. He was eloquent. He was theatrical. He was charismatic. He looked great. And his importance at that time was it was the first time that somebody who had suffered through this kind of injustice could communicate it to the audience in the way that nobody before him ever could. And it pushed the abolitionist movement forward. So Garrison asked him to come out and speak and go from town to town, city to city, and just tell your story, Frederick. Well, he started to have a problem. And that was people started to doubt he'd ever been a slave. This man was shattering their notion of what they thought slaves were, what the government and what the slave master put out there. And so it wasn't computing with people. They were hearing him speak, and he's educated, and how could this man be a slave? He's not a slave. He's a fraud. Well, in order to prove that he was, he wrote that autobiography, which became a bestseller. And in it, he named names and he named places, and he talked about his master. Now, think about this. If you're on the run from your master, the last thing that you want is the notoriety of a best-selling book and the celebrity that came along with it, because he was now an instant household name, and he was in danger of being captured. So the Garrisonians suggested that he go to Europe and speak about slavery over there as a cooling-off period. And while he was over there for 2 years, his abolitionist friends there pooled their money together and purchased his freedom from his master for $711. And he was able to come back to the United States. He would settle in Rochester, New York, publish the North Star newspaper, which was the leading abolitionist voice. He became an advisor to presidents, particularly Abraham Lincoln. And he and the abolitionists were responsible for pushing President Lincoln to the point where he would make the right decision and sign the Emancipation Proclamation. Because Lincoln was a politician. He said, if I could keep slavery and save the Union, I would do that. If I could end slavery and save the Union, I would do that. So he was on the fence, and the friendship that developed between Douglass and Lincoln was important because Lincoln saw this former slave, this African American, as his equal. And I truly believe that had they not had that friendship, had the abolitionists not pushed President Lincoln to do the right thing, the slavery could have gone on for who knows how much longer, and we'd be a very different country than we are today. So Booker T. Washington, as I mentioned, he was freed when he was 9 years old, when that document was signed. He wanted to go to school so badly that he worked in the salt and coal mines of West Virginia at night so that he could begin to take classes during the day. And he wanted to save enough money to go to college. That was his dream. And one night, when he was in the salt mines, he heard these two older gentlemen talking about this place called Hampton Institute. And they were talking about how you can get an education if you go to Hampton. Now, Booker didn't know what Hampton was, but what he was hearing about education, to him, it sounded like heaven. And he was going to do everything that he could to eventually go to Hampton. So he would continue to work, finally save enough money, and with the help of the community coming together and pooling their money, he would make a 500-mile walk to go to school, which I find the irony here in the fact that Barry is making the exact same walk as far as mileage. And I don't mean to scare him when I tell him what happened, but that walk took a long time. And Booker ran out of money several times. And he had to take odd jobs. He slept outside. He had to sleep under bridges. And the funny thing is when I mentioned this just yesterday, one of the presentations afterwards, Barry said to me, "So he had to sleep under a bridge?" And I was thinking he was going to say, "Oh, man, I don't know if I want to do this." Barry said, "I got to find a bridge so I can sleep under." To experience what these freedom seekers would have experienced. So he makes this 500-mile walk to Hampton at 16 years old. He gets there, and he goes right to the headmistress of the school, and he said, "I want to go to school here." And she took one look at him, and he's dirty, he's disheveled, his clothes are torn, he probably didn't smell so good. And she said, "There's no way. No, you're not going to school here. I mean, look at you. You're not worthy of this institution." But he wouldn't take no for an answer. Because when he was in the salt and coal mines of West Virginia, he learned the value of hard work and perseverance and never giving up and never letting any obstacle slow him down. And so now he's right there face to face with her. And she said, "Okay," she got tired of him asking, just, okay, leave me alone. "Here, why don't you prove yourself? I'll give you an opportunity to prove yourself. There's a dirty classroom over here. Go over there and clean it and let's see what you can do." So he gets in there and he cleans and he's finished. And she comes in to do the white glove test. She can't find a speck of dirt anywhere. She can't find any dust. And she's so impressed with him that she looks at him and she said, "Okay, you will do for admission. Not only that, we're going to give you the job as a janitor so that you can work your way through school." And this is how he was able to get through Hampton. He would graduate, come back, and teach at the school. And while he was there, he was asked at the age of 25 years old to come down to this place called Tuskegee, Alabama, in 1881 to start a school for formerly enslaved Americans. And he thought, "Well, that sounds like a challenge. That sounds like a great job. I'm going to take it." So he goes down to Tuskegee, and he's looking around, and he's looking for a schoolhouse or a church or somewhere where he could teach classes, just a room. But there was nothing but dirt. As far as the eyes can see, there was nothing but dirt. He didn't let that deter him, because what he did was he started recruiting students, and he started getting them excited about getting an education. And then the first thing that he taught them how to do was to make bricks. Why would he teach them how to make bricks? So they could build their own school. And that's exactly what they did. And Tuskegee University is still there today, has educated millions of families, and the legacy of Booker T. Washington is there in Alabama. And these are the original pictures of the picture of students building their own school with the bricks. He also understood that if we're going to start education, now many of you have studied Washington or W.E.B. Du Bois, know this debate. Booker T. Washington was working really from the ground up. Du Bois, who was reaching for the higher aims in life and education, was working from the top down. And the way that I always describe what was happening, in my opinion, was you have Booker T. Washington, who was born a slave. He came from the fields with a till under his arm. Du Bois was born free, and he came from the city with books under his arms. So there's no doubt that they would have a different philosophy on how their people would advance. So one was working from the top down, one was working from the bottom up, and advancement met in the middle. So Booker said in his philosophy, how can we start reaching for the higher aims in life if we haven't even met our basic needs in life? So he taught a trade to the students. He taught them a tool like dressmaking, how to farm the land, how to acquire land, how to become businessmen, understanding that if we're coming out of the legacy of slavery, which was race-based slavery, the racism was intense. And he understood that you couldn't just start to get people to change their minds just by saying, "Hey, you should change your minds." So he believed that if you could do something, you would have some value and some use, and people would not care so much about the color of your skin. So rather than demanding that the white race just change their ways, Booker T. Washington showed freed African Americans how they could change themselves, how they could overcome obstacles, develop strength of character, and rise by their own efforts to honorable positions of respect, but most importantly, self-esteem. So Washington was a leader who brought stability in a time of transition from enslavement to freedom, and it may be said that he is the person that bridged the gap between the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation and the Civil Rights Movement. So I've always known that I descended from these men. I can't really say when I first really realized their importance, but I know growing up, I would see them on statues looking down at me. I'm looking up at them. And I saw my ancestors. They were on stamps. They were on money. Bridges were named for them. Libraries were named for them. Schools. Everywhere I turned, I was in the long, vast shadow of my ancestors. Now, my earliest memory of their importance was when I was about 5 years old. And I spent all of my summers in Frederick Douglass's summer beach house, which was built by my great-great-grandfather Charles on the Chesapeake Bay as a retirement home for his dad. And when the home was being built, Frederick asked Charles, "Can you put a special feature in the house for me? And I want to call it the tower." And what he wanted to do was he wanted to sit up in that tower, and the house was strategically located right on the water facing the eastern shore of Maryland. So Frederick wanted to sit up in that tower, and he wanted to look back across the bay, and on the other side you could see the shore, and that's where he was born into slavery and where he toiled away in chains. So you remember I said history is important because we need to know where we've come from in order to know where we're headed. Here's a man who had accomplished so much, and at this point he's a statesman, and he wanted to sit up in that house and never forget where he had come from and how far he had come. So I spent all of my summers in that house surrounded by Douglas and Washington family images. And at the top of the staircase is this larger-than-life portrait of Frederick Douglass. And we've all seen the photographs. He looks serious. He looks intense. He's glaring into the camera to make a point because he did not want to portray himself as a happy or amiable fugitive. So he was very strategic in the way that he distributed these photographic images of himself. So as a little boy, 5 years old, I'm looking at him, looking down at me, and I remember looking up and thinking, "You look mean." You know, we probably all have ancestors that we think, "I'm glad I didn't know you." And as I tried to inconspicuously sneak past that photograph, or that painting, you know what would happen? His eyes would follow me. And by the time I would get down to the end of the hallway, I could feel his steely glare burning like fire on the back of my neck. And you know, kids, and I certainly did, had a wild imagination. And I always imagined this booming baritone voice bellowing down upon my tiny person and saying, "You will do great things, young man." And I looked back and I thought, I don't want anything to do with that. That was a lot of pressure. And it was pressure that I felt at the age of 5. And as I got older, you know, the few times that I told my classmates of my relationship, nobody ever believed me. And I never thought that it was a point worth arguing. So when you're a little boy and you have some teachers that don't necessarily believe you, or a principal, you don't want to talk about it. You're embarrassed. So I spent my whole life running away from it. And I'd also seen what the legacies had done to those that came before me. I talked about my grandfather, who was the surgeon, Frederick Douglass III. He always walked around with this weight of expectation on his shoulders to be great like Frederick Douglass. And people expected him to be an iconic leader like Frederick Douglass. But there's only one Douglass. And that weight of expectation became too much for him to carry. And when my grandmother was 3 months pregnant with my mom, he took his own life. So my mother was born without a father. She was raised without a father. And then when I came along and I had this dual lineage, my parents and grandparents went in the complete opposite direction. And they weren't going to force anything on me. And I'm thankful for that. But But I grew up decisively disengaged from this lineage until Providence called in my life, and that was my good friend and business partner, Robert Benz, who's also a co-founder of our organization, found this National Geographic magazine. And the cover story was 21st Century Slaves. And I looked at that headline and reacted the way I think most people do the first time they hear about the existence of human trafficking and modern-day slavery. And I thought slavery had ended. I mean, the public thinks, for the most part, slavery had ended with the Emancipation Proclamation. But as I started to research the issue, I found that slavery still existed in every civilized and uncivilized country around the world, including right here in the United States. And today, slavery affects every race in the human family. There are millions of people enslaved, and we've heard numbers at 27 million, 30 million, 12 million. Because this is an underground illegal activity, we knew in the 19th century that there were 4 million slaves because it was legal. Today, we don't really know how many there are, except we do know that there are more slaves today than during the whole transatlantic slave trade. So there are millions. We're still trying to count. It's hard to count what you can't see. It's an underground illegal activity. But what we do know is that the traffickers prey on the most vulnerable, and that means women and children for the most part. 50% of the slaves today are children. So I'm reading this story, and I'm researching about this issue, and I come across a story about a 12-year-old girl who was forced to be a sex slave in the brothels of Southeast Asia and service 15 to 20 men a day. And down the hallway, it was nighttime, I could hear my girls getting ready for bed, and at the time, my daughters were 12 and 9, so the same age. And they're laughing, and they're reading bedtime stories, and they're getting ready to get down on their knees and say their prayers. And I'm just having this impossible time trying to wrap my mind around what I'm reading about this 12-year-old girl and what I'm hearing from these 12 and 9-year-old girls down the hallway. And as I set the magazine down, I walked into their rooms to say goodnight to them. And I had this moment where I couldn't look them in the eyes. And I was reminded of Alex Haley's roots. We all remember that. And for you young people that don't, Alex Haley was an author, and he traced his family tree, his lineage, all the way back to Africa. And then ABC Network made a miniseries about it that ran for a week in the 70s. And millions of Americans watched this story unfold every night. It was the first time we were seeing what slavery looks like in this country. So people were just riveted to their television screen. And I remember watching that, being a teenager, and thinking, if I were there then, I would be a Frederick Douglass. I would be an abolitionist. And I think all of us believe that, that we would fight for those that can't fight for themselves. We would speak for those that can't speak for themselves and fight against injustice. And that's how I felt watching that. Well, the problem with that thinking was I could never prove that to myself because you're talking about crimes of the past. Well, now all of a sudden, here I am faced with a present-day crime, and I couldn't look my girls in the eyes and just walk away and not do anything. And it was at that moment that I understood, and Robert understood, that we had this platform that my ancestors had built through struggle and through sacrifice. And we knew that we could leverage the historical significance of my ancestry to do something about this. There would be opportunities that groups would want me just to come in and talk about the history. But wait a minute, we've got the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, the great educator Booker T. Washington. So how do we go about educating the public on this? Abolition through education. And if we're going to start with education, we have to start where it should start, and that's with young people. So we went into schools initially. We started with schools named after Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington because we figured they wouldn't turn us down. And we were able to get in about 35 or 40 of those schools when we first started in 2008. And we went in and we talked about the great heroes and heroines that came before, because most of the students knew about the Civil Rights Movement and Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr., but they didn't know that Frederick Douglass was the father of the Civil Rights Movement. And they got inspired by hearing this history. And again, what I talked about these examples of overcoming obstacles, it inspired the students. They loved this history. And then we would ask them to look through the prism of history, and that slavery still exists, and we need modern-day abolitionists to do exactly what Frederick Douglass did. So they would learn about labor exploitation and how, and ask themselves critical questions like, are we as consumers, and I'll ask you guys this, are we as consumers complicit in allowing slavery to thrive and exist because we demand products so cheaply? So let's think about this. If we were in the 19th century, and the way that we teach in the classroom in our curricula is we go back and forth from history to contemporary forms of slavery so that students and teachers see that when you boil down the basic elements of slavery, it comes down to just a few things. It comes down to profit, it's about money, and about exploiting the most vulnerable. Slavery today is about that, and slavery in the 19th century was about that. So if we were in the 19th century, and we were in, let's say, a northern city, we were in Michigan, northern state, and you wanted to buy a cotton t-shirt, you wanted to get that t-shirt at a great price, you wanted it to be good quality, and you wanted it to feel good, so this is nice, soft cotton. And you might not be thinking about how that cotton was harvested down south, and who was being brutalized and exploited and dehumanized to create that t-shirt. Well, it's the same thing today. We as consumers want products cheaply, and we don't always think about the supply chain of these multinational corporations that have sent jobs overseas, and they hire contractors, so way down the supply chain, they're producing these products many times with slave labor. So are we as consumers, are we a part of that? Are we allowing that to exist and thrive if we don't demand of our lawmakers and demand of our corporations that they clean up their supply chain, and they just can't wipe their hands and say, well, we don't know, it's way down the line, and we don't know how they're producing these products so cheaply for us. So students, when they hear that, they get outraged. And they want to do things. They want to write letters to their lawmakers. They want to go down to the local grocery store and find out if the chocolate was that chocolate made with slave labor in Africa with an African boy who's 6, 7 years old who climbs up a tree to harvest that cocoa to make the chocolate. Or African boys on Lake Volta in Ghana who are swimming in disease-infested water to harvest the fish and the seafood because their hands are small enough to take the fish out of the nets. Or little girls that are weaving the rugs that we stand on or making the clothes that we make, or it's in the electronics. Students, when they hear that, they get empowered to want to do something about it. And we have seen them do amazing service projects. There's always service that's connected to this learning. So what they learn in the classroom about historic slavery, contemporary slavery, then they go into the communities and do work. We've had students that have presented at the UN. I mean, these are young ladies that are coming from vulnerable situations. They're the demographic of those that are most vulnerable, and they're being empowered. Booker T. Washington said, if you want to lift up yourself, lift up someone else. So we have our young people that are working on this global issue that's greater than they are, and they're seeing that there are men, women, and children around the world that are facing greater challenges in their own lives than these young people are facing. And we're seeing incredible, amazing transformation when they begin to do this work. And what's happening is they're being protected because we're providing information that's going to prevent them from becoming victims in the first place. We're talking to young boys at an age when they're forming their identity and their character and who they're going to become about their attitudes and choices that they make with regard to women and girls, and ask them questions like, if you were to make this choice as a young man, or as an adult male, would you want your sister or your mother or your aunt being treated in this way? So you can either become a part of the problem or you can be a part of the solution. And again, what I said about building strong children rather than repairing broken men, this is how we're going to get at this issue long term, because it's institutionalized knowledge. Now, history lives in each of us. History doesn't just live in me, because I descend from two people that we've heard of that are famous. But history lives in each and every one of you. And again, when we're talking to students who have no idea where they come from, to help them understand that if you were to go back and research your own family tree, you're going to find great people that sacrificed so much, that may have given of their lives, just so that some of us have the right to even sit in a classroom and get an education, or may have given of their lives just for the freedoms that we enjoy. And when young people start to understand that they have greatness flowing through their veins, just like I do, you see them sitting up straighter in their chairs, and you see them, this light bulb goes off, that, and they'll say, so I walk in the shoes of those that came before me, and I stand on the shoulders of those that came before me, and they're being transformed, and then they're ready, and they're empowered to go out into the community and to do work, this important work. So history lives in each of us, but the future depends on how we carry that forth. Because we are the sons and daughters. We're the grandsons and granddaughters. Some of us are the products of slavery. This country is the product of slavery. This country is also the product of the abolition of slavery. From Frederick Douglass, we learned that we have a right to be free. And from Booker T. Washington, we learned how to make our way in the world as free citizens. And from Martin Luther King Jr., we learned that as free citizens, we have the same rights as all citizens. When I was growing up, the challenges faced by great men like Douglass and Washington were apparent to me because it just so happens their blood runs through my veins. But the fact is, all of us in here tonight, we live far from the cotton fields. And we're worried more today about our favorite sports team winning a ball game than we are about the threat of being beaten by our overseers. We live in modern times, and the echoes of slavery are sometimes hard to hear from where we stand. But if we all listen close enough, we'll hear cries and not echoes from the slaves of today. And if we listen close enough, we'll hear cries and not echoes from all of the young people out there that need hope, need inspiration, need to be inspired by great teachers like Barry Jurgensen. And when we listen close enough, that's when change will happen. So I'm going to close here. I mentioned I was born in Washington, D.C., and this is Frederick Douglass's home. It's now a National Historic Site. And we used to go on field trips to this house. I loved visiting it. I loved sitting in the rocking chair on the front porch and looking out in the distance. It's on a hill called Cedar Hill. And he did a lot of things in life, but among other things, he knew how to pick out a piece of property. Because if you look out in the distance, you could see the Capitol, you could see the Washington Monument, you could see the White House. But what I loved most about the house was when we would go inside, one of the first rooms off to the left is his library. And when you go in the library, you see books everywhere, from the ceiling to the floor. And I remember thinking, that's how he got his education. He read all of those books, never spent one day of his life in the classroom. And then if you go upstairs, and down the hallway, at the end of the hallway, is his bedroom. And you know how when you go into museums, they always have that velvet rope that blocks off the room so you can't get in and touch anything? Whenever I went in the house, I wanted to touch everything. I was touching the china and the crystal, and the docents, tour guides would smack my hand. They'd say, you can't touch that. Stop touching everything. And when my grandmother Washington would be with me, she would look at him and she would say, oh, yes, he can. They belong to him. Now if you go into the house, there's plexiglass blocking all that stuff because of me. But from the hallway into the room is this rope. And I always wanted to see what was in that room. And so I would stretch my neck over the rope as far as I could. And if I looked to the left, I could see his bed. And on his bed, laid out nicely, is his nightshirt. And next to the bed, on a chair, is the Panama hat that he wore when he was consul general and minister to Haiti. And next to the chair on a floor is a pair of his shoes. And when I was a little boy, I always wanted to sneak past that rope and try those shoes on. And when we first got started, the first speech I gave was at this house. And it was for a group of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And I told that story, and this young girl from the back of the room raised her hand, and she said, Mr. Morris, I want to know what it must be like to walk in the shoes of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. And I said, how old are you? And she was 10. And I thought, wow, that's a deep question. I had to start getting introspective with it. So I finished my presentation. The site manager heard all of this, and she said, I got an idea. We're going to go on a special VIP tour. So there were about 25 students and me. And so we rushed up from the visitor center at the bottom of the hill all the way up to the front door, and I'm knocking the kids over trying to get in the house first into the library, and so excited to bring them in and say, look at these books, look at the books. And they're going, wow, that's cool. Let's go upstairs. So I beat them upstairs and down the hallway, and boom, there's the rope. And there are the shoes that have been looking at me for 45 plus years. Well, the site manager did something they'd never done before. All the times I've been in this house, she took down the rope and she said, come on in. So we all rushed in, and it's not a big room, so we were in there really crammed together, shoulder to shoulder, almost like sardines like this. And so the photographer, when he was ready to take the picture, the group photograph, he started placing people. And he said, you go here, you go here, you go here. And as he's getting closer to me, do you know where he put me? Right next to the shoes. And I looked down, I was like this, and I looked down and I said, there they are. After all of these years, all I would have to do is just slip off my shoes, and I could slide right into them, and no one would ever know. And I'd be sitting there taking pictures in Frederick Douglass's shoes. Look at me. But I never did. I know. I never tried those shoes on because I knew they wouldn't fit. Those shoes are too big for any of us to fit into. But what I realized at that moment was that I could take the shoes that I've got. You all can take the shoes that you've got, and we can lead the way to a brighter future. We can lead the way to a better tomorrow. And each and every one of us can rally all of these young people around us and these students and affect change in the world around us in the same way that my ancestors did and many others. So with that, I thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you for listening, and God bless you all.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Washington County Historical Association on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Kenneth Morris, great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, and great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, as well as co-founder and president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative in Atlanta, Georgia. He spoke on the topic, history, human rights, and the power of one. His remarks were given as the keynote of a fundraising effort to enable Arlington Public Schools history teacher Barry Jurgensen to retrace the 500-mile route from Nebraska City to Chicago of two escaped slaves who traveled the path to freedom through the Underground Railroad in 1858. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, March 11, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Mr. Jurgensen did complete the 500-mile walk from Nebraska City to Chicago this past summer. He'll give a talk about his journey at the Washington County Museum in Fort Calhoun this Wednesday evening, September 28th at 7 o'clock. Special thanks to Julie Ashton, director of the Washington County Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.